now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Hello everyone and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classic cults and all the cheese in between, the movies are B, the entertainment is grade A, and I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti, and I'm joined once again by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Hi Jay, how are you doing? Today we're going to do The Fly, yeah. The 1958 version, not the one that was redone in the 80s.
In the 80s, yeah. All right folks, we'll get to it right after this.
Will everyone in the theater hold on firmly to his seat, please?
Stop it! Stop it!
I'm Vincent Price. What unearthly horror did that girl gaze upon? What manner of incredible thing walked beneath that hood? It would be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
It isn't like any other fly I've ever seen.
No! 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 Please, let me look at the fly!
I've killed Andre. Please help me. Call the police and...
The charge can only be murder.
There were no mistresses. I had no lovers.
Why did you kill him?
God, don't let it get out.
Inspector. Inspector, it's in the garden. Come quickly.
As God is my witness, I saw the thing. It's unbelievable. I shall never forget that scream as long as I live.
Flies on its way. Watch out for it. It's far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
The Fly was released in 1958 and was directed by Kurt Newman. Produced by Robert L. Lippert and Kurt Newman. The screenplay was by James Clavell, and it was actually based on the short story The Fly from a 1957 issue of Playboy by George Langland. Music by Paul Sautel. Paul Sautel is a name we've heard before on this show. 20th Century Fox both produced and distributed the movie with a running time of 93 minutes. It was made on a budget of just under $500,000 and had a box office of over $3 million. Our stars here, obviously, they're Americans here, and when we're talking about, we'll get to in a minute, you'll hear as we're talking about all the French names that are in here and why that happens. But the main star here is Al Hedison, right? And some of you may know him as David Hennison. He went later that, and you said he was the captain.
Captain on the Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea TV show.
Right, yeah, which is not different than the movie. Right. Patricia Owens. Of course, Vincent Price is the one everyone knows from here. He's on the poster. Herbert Marshall. And then, as we'll go through, and those are your main players. Those are the ones who are in most of this. Here we go. So, special effects. We'll talk about them as we get to them. The two special effects artists were L.B. Abbott and Bill... Ben, not Bill Nye. Bill Nye is a science guy. Ben Nye. We'll talk about them as we get there, and the mask and the makeup that was involved here. So, in Montreal, Canada, scientist André Delambre is found dead with his head and arm crushed in a hydraulic press. Although his wife, Helena, confesses to the crime, she refuses to provide a motive and begins to act strangely. In particular, she's obsessed with flies, including a supposedly white-headed fly. André's brother, Francois, that's Vincent Price, lies and says he caught the white-headed fly, and thinking he knows the truth, Helena explains the circumstances surrounding André's death. Now, let's just cut it there for a second. So this movie opens in media res. Okay, we're in the middle of the story.
Yeah.
Right, it opens, what I'm saying, but that's very different than a lot of the stories we're talking about here. It's very reminiscent of the way Godzilla opens media res. We open Godzilla King of Monsters, and they're in the hospital already. He's already destroyed everything. And most of the story is told in the flashback. So at this point, all we've seen, and one of the things with the press, if this movie was made, this is 58, you make this movie 10 years later, you're going to see a press with blood everywhere. They don't show the press. I mean, obviously, his head has been crushed. And when they raise the press, everyone kind of like turns away. You know, except Herbert Marshall. I'm good with this. He's all tough. So, all right. In a flashback, André, Helena, and their son Philippe are a happy family. André has been working on a matter transporter device called the Disintegrator Integrator. Because a lot of integration happened there. He initially tested on only small inanimate objects, but he eventually proceeds to living creatures, including the family pet cat, which fails to reintegrate, and it's just floating. That's one of my favorites. It's like, where is he? Your voice in space. that's a joke. Obviously, it was here, from here, and that joke has showed up in a lot of different things
later.
I mean, it becomes a joke of like that. Very different than when they... in Cronenberg's A Fly, he takes the baboon, right?
Yeah.
And he sends him through, and it turns it inside out. And again, how different a movie could it be, you know, with Cronenberg compared to Kurt Newman directing here? And then eventually a guinea pig. After he satisfies that the tests are succeeding, he builds a man-sized pair of chambers. One day, Helena, worried about André, has not come up to the basement lab for a couple days, goes down to find André with a black cloth over his head and a strange deformity in his left hand. Communicating with typed notes only, André tells Helena that he, as I turn the page, he tried to transport himself, but a fly was caught in the chamber with him, which resulted in the mixing of their atoms. Now he has the head and left arm of a fly, and the fly has a miniature head and a left arm, though he keeps his mind. André needs Helena to capture the fly so he can reverse the process. Although she expends great effort in her search, she cannot find it, and André will begin to fade as the fly's instincts take over his brain. Time is running out, and while André can still think like a human, he smashes the equipment, burns his notes, leads Helena to the factory, and when they arrive, he sets the hydraulic press and motions for Helena to push the button. She activates the press twice, once to crush his head and once to crush his left arm. Now, that's one of the things, even as a kid growing up, I get it, like, his arm fell out, but it's just like, you know, like, I mean, because he's fighting with anybody she tries to pull her under, like, I guess it's hard, because as a kid, you're like, well, why does she even bother going over there? Why is she, just crush the guy, like, he's a fly, like, it's just, there's no compassion when you're 7 watching this kind of thing, because I watched it with Haley the other day, this with Haley, right, and Haley's like, well, she crushed him. Why did she go over? And I go, well, it's her husband and she loves him. She goes, yeah, but it doesn't look like her husband. Like, you know, kind of, you know, Haley's logical. Like, it might taste like ketchup, but brother, it ain't ketchup. That's Haley for you. Upon hearing this confession, the chief detective of the case, Inspector Shiraz, deems Helena insane and guilty of murder. As they're about to haul her away, Philippe tells Francois that he's seen the fly trapped in the web in the garden. Francois convinces the inspector to come see and see for himself. The two men see the fly trapped in the web with both Andre's head and arm. It screams, "Help me! Help me!" as a large brown spider advances on it. Just as the spider's about to devour the creature, Shiraz crushes them both with a rock. Knowing that no one believed the truth, he and Francois decide to declare Andre's death a suicide so that Helena isn't convicted of murder. In the end, Helena, Francois, Philippe resume their daily lives, with Francois explaining to Philippe that Andre died doing the most dangerous act of humanity, but also the most important, the search for the truth. Okay, so, this movie was a very big hit when it came out. This was critically acclaimed, and this was a big hit. I mean, Vincent Price, it was a bankable star enough in certain circles. Well, he was.
Well, no, but Vincent Price, he started acting in the mid to late 30s. He had not done any...
No, all the other stuff that came after. I'm saying, but he became a star. Vincent Price's name couldn't carry the movie, but he was an actor. People were like, oh, I like him. Like, it wasn't like, who's this guy?
You know? Well, yeah, I mean, even though he gets top billing on the posters and stuff, he's not the main character. Al Hedison is. And his role is more of a... he ties in the whole story because he's there looking at all of the different aspects of it, and even he has doubts about her not being a murderer. And then you see as the story unfolds how his role then expands a little bit to the end. I mean, even in the follow-on movie Return of the Fly, he's now the head of DeLambre Enterprises.
Right.
But this is more a thriller than it is a monster movie. And up until this time, he was really more of a dramatic actor. Now, he did act in two movies called... One was House of Wax, which was a 3D rush to the screen to try to capitalize on the television invasion on the movies to get people to go to the movies for some other reason, which was 3D. And then he was also in The Mad Magician. And that was where he was more of a... Again, not a mad scientist, but just someone who was—he was caught up in his own, how do you put it, in his own life.
Right.
But as an actor now, this was 3 or 4 years before he became.
He became a much bigger star.
But it was through Roger Corman.
Well, those small movies, yes. But I'm saying, but he was a name. At this point, it wasn't like he was the leading man. Like, he's not Clark Gable or Cary Grant. Like, his name on a movie sells the movie. But Vincent Price was a guy. People go, oh, that guy. Like, he was a respectable actor.
Yeah, he was always...
But he was in...
He was in The Ten Commandments.
But he was in Tower of London and stuff like that.
He wasn't the henchman.
I'm saying is, like, he always played... At that point, he was playing second and thirds.
Right, yeah.
But he was a guy that you kind of had a name. He was not Boris Karloff. He was not Bela Lugosi. It wasn't like... Karloff, the uncanny, in The Mummy. Like, it wasn't that. It wasn't like Vincent Price in The Fly, but he's not The Fly, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
So
that's it. And when you see this movie and you see his name Vincent Price, you're really not sure what you think you know what you're going to see, but at this point, obviously he's not the creature.
Yeah.
But
so when this was released in 1958, it was actually double billed with Space Master X7. Which I don't think I've ever even heard of.
Yes.
So, but that's what it was. Space Master X7. And that would be because of Lippert. Lippert himself, who was one of the producers, that was one of his cheapies. He did, I think it's called King Dinosaur. Oh. Which, if you've ever seen King Dinosaur, and it wasn't well, Misty did it. They made fun of it. I mean,
yes.
but you're watching this going, wow. And that's the one where he's yanking that poor girl. Whoever that woman's with him, he's like, get down. And he like shoves her down and beats the crap out of her. And like, I'm like, dude, like, are you kidding? And she finally at the end goes, don't touch me. And she like kicks him. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, that's what Richard Boone, who
well, that's
was,
what the, that's what they
Paladin.
Have. They have the what do you call in their hand? They have the nuclear warhead. Because we're going to space, so we always bring a nuclear warhead with us. And then they nuke the planet, but they're okay.
Yes.
Should we shield our eyes from what? I don't know. Fallout?
Well,
anyway.
Let's get back to the fly.
Yeah. So, obviously, it received a lot of critical praise. The audience loved it. And it actually became Kurt Newman's biggest box office success of his career. The problem was, he died a few months after the premiere and only weeks before it went into general release. He actually never even got to reap any rewards of this. So, this movie was very, very... And it's one of the science fiction movies that's referenced constantly. The Fly.
Right.
The idea of The Fly... This version of The Fly, not Cronenberg's Fly. Cronenberg's Fly is a horror movie. That is definitely a horror movie. this one is referenced throughout science fiction now. I mean, even things as simple as, like, on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, they have a guy who gets mutated. Pretty relevant everywhere. So, you know, it's actually funny. Michael Rennie, it was offered the lead.
Really?
And he said no. Because they said, well, he goes, well, yeah, I'll be a lead. Okay, sounds good. Like, this is a good big movie. They showed him he had to wear the head and the hand. He goes, nope, not wearing that, because he'd be covered up too much of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he actually, that's why he turned the role down. And that would have been kind of funny, because he was in...
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah,
The Day
the Earth Still. Yeah. Right? Which is, again, around the same time. But that role where you see his face the entire time. You know, kind of, and that's a, you know, again, Day the Earth Stood Still. If you want to talk about a movie that is referenced in science fiction from, you know, still today, The Fly... Day the Earth Stood Still, like things like that. Invasion of Saucermen to like the little green
man.
No.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, Invasion. Well, yeah, yes. Well, that's Don Siegel. That's a different kind of thing. But that's also a metaphor for you know, communism and everything. Yeah. I mean, that stuff even touches. We're back. Sorry about that, folks. A little technical difficulties here. So like we were saying how Michael Rennie was offered the role, and you know, he went on to be in The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a very big science fiction movie in reference. Then we talk Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is one of my favorite movies, period, of all time, and Don Siegel and stuff like that that goes in that.
Yeah, and Michael Rennie, he actually was the lead actor in the 1960 The Lost World.
Right.
That Harryhausen did not do.
No. So, it just was just some funny stuff about the teleportation that causes Andre and the Fly is never shown, which is, I think, a big thing, because in Cronenberg's, they definitely want to show that the fly is in there with them and they're going to be recognizing stuff. So, there's a lot of that kind of left out, and you have to kind of figure that. And we mentioned that Robert Lippert, who originally was an uncredited producer, but then later put his name, his company was called Regal Films, and they did King Dinosaur and all that other, you know, stuff. And Space Master X7 was not a movie which 20th Century Fox used as a co-feature of the film, because they got it really cheap. So that movie was able to make a bunch of money off of The Fly.
Right.
And he knew what he was doing. He willing to give him a little bit of money and get his, you know, get in there as producer. And, hey, I got a movie. And they're like, great, we don't have to shoot it. Stick it on there, kind of thing. You know, how disappointing would that be? Like, I mean, I hope they showed Rocket Ship or whatever, Space Master XM7 first. Because imagine, I mean, not that The Fly is like, oh my God, like the most, you know, I mean, it's a good movie, but it's not going to blow you away. But can you imagine how disappointing it must be to see a movie that no one's ever heard of? I've never heard of Space Master X7.
No.
Made the list of movies made in 1958, technically. So, you know, kind of.
You know, I'm trying to remember when my brother and I used to go to the movies to see these. Usually there was four movies on a Saturday morning.
Right,
so
right.
They would play. Maybe they'd start off with a Western, then they would go right to the main feature, and then there would be a comedy, and then there would be the fourth one. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm not sure how they would have. I would assume they would have played The Fly first, because if people are sitting there and this
other
movie...
Well, The Fly is the feature.
Yeah, that's
so
what
you
I mean.
Play your if, yeah yeah The Fly would have to play. Yeah. I'm just saying is like I mean if you're only seeing the two movies, if you're getting four movies, you'd have the Western or whatever, and then you know kind of thing. Anyway, what is it? Andre actually wears the exact same clothes the entire film, except when they go to the ballet. Right? It's hard to you think about it, but it makes perfect sense. He shouldn't be changing his clothes. He never leaves the basement.
That's right.
He got smell real bad. That's what I'm saying. He's stinkerific down there. So the scene, the most memorable scene in this movie, there's two of them. There's the unmasking when they pull it off, and Patricia Owens had never actually seen the makeup because she's actually afraid of insects. So they purposely, when Kurt Newman didn't let her see anything, they pulled it off, and that's her real reaction. One take, you got it, because she really screams. I mean, she's letting it out. You know?
And that scene, that's the classic multifaceted view that the fly would have.
They're all pictures like the different eye. Yeah,
right. And that's really what that L.B. Abbott, his special effects wore. He was not a monster maker, but he would do things like that. He would do gunshots. He would do like a mist and things. But that was his forte.
Yeah, I mean, the fly makeup itself is very effective. Its minimal use in the movie, I think, helps it. because you know, because you're hiding and people want to know what it looks like. I mean, the hand you kind of see, but the hand, like, well, what is it, you know, kind of thing. And but once you see the fly itself, I think that shock value hits you quickly, and it's good. Again, you know, we're watching this now. I mean, you know, you saw it when you were younger.
Right.
I mean, we saw it as Luke and I saw it as children, and my daughter watched it for the first time the other day. But it didn't shock her because, I mean, let's be honest, she's like, "It's a fly, okay?" Like she, I think, I mean, while she has not sat through Cronenberg's Fly because there's a little too much nudity in it for her, because she gets really crazy if anyone gets naked in a movie, except the Minions. The Minion tushy, she thinks that's hysterical. But like, you know, but to her, like. The trailer for Cronenberg's The Fly was on this disc, and she's like, oh, is he puking on him? Like, it's like, that's gross. Like, it's not like she's like, you know, scared of it. To her, it's this crazy mutation all happening. He pulled the mask, the hang off. She goes, I've seen that before. And she has, of course, because, you know, it's the model kit I've built and the things we have, you know, kind of like that. So to her, it's not shocking. To shock Haley, you gotta be like, you gotta hit her with something she's never seen. But I think it really is effective, and I like how the little thing that clearly must be in his mouth. He must have it in his mouth. I mean, movement with his mouth. It kind of vibrates quickly, and it looks good. And those hairs look really sharp, which a fly's hair would look. And it really is spot on. And I think keeping it hidden, because it's hidden till almost the very, very end.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not on screen with that long, and then he covers up again. You know, and it's not like they put it out there and he's walking around with the thing. You
know? And it's not like they wanted to hide it. It was just, that's part of the story.
But that makes perfect sense in the story. Yeah,
now, the thing that makes the anticipation of seeing the fly so strong is that throughout the movie, at certain times, there is a buzzing sound that is pervasive in the background of
there's a lot of flies
scenes in
that house, though.
Well, no, but again, but the windows are open.
Well, you notice the window is broken on the bottom there. Like, it's all these little things. You're like, okay, but like, there's flies in the house, and they're like chasing them down. And I'm like, and I'm thinking, like, 1957, you know, so we're not talking about, like, you know, necessarily windows that are like double paned or whatever kind of thing, you know, whatever, but it just seems like, but and there is that buzzing sound.
Yeah, and it's subtle, it's in the background, but when you hear it,
you know
something is coming.
Well, also, too, the way he eats, when he asks for the milk with the brandy, and she makes a crow's breakfast out of bringing that down to him. She sloshes that thing everywhere kind of thing. But then he's slurping it up. And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, it becomes very clear that, obviously, you know, directors who made movies in the 70s and 80s and the 90s, a lot of them got their, you know, they were all children of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and that's when they were growing up on these things, and they took that there. When in Cronenberg's The Fly, when he has to show you him vomiting and then slurping it up, and he goes, oh, that's gross. Like, yeah, that's gross, dude. Like, your bundle fly vomits on the stuff and then slurps it all up. Well, you hear him slurping it up. The one thing, though, is they don't show you having him vomiting on the meat.
The meat.
But he's slurping up the meat. Well, he's clearly not slurping up solid meat. I mean, you know, that's even a Vitamix. You're not going to be able to make that into anything, you know, kind of thing. So I'm just saying, no chunks. Look, it's smooth. Anyway, so, you know, but I think that was good. I think that, but it's the old Hitchcock thing. If I have a bomb go off in a room, you're shocked for 5-10 seconds. If I tell you there's a bomb in the room and then show the people in the room and then show there's a bomb in the room and then tell you that, you know, you have that anticipation. You know there's something wrong with him. They show you the hand after the second time he's down there, and he showed that he has to stop the hand from trying to kill her. Like, it's trying to go after her. So part of that is helping you kind of build that sense of, like, okay, there's something really wrong here. So the other, of course, famous scene is the help me, the little fly. It is famous because...
Yes.
And, you know, not just because we built one, and it's the size... What is that? How big is that?
Well, no, The actual piece itself that's in the middle is a 1/8 scale, and it's just the...
No, it's more than 1/8 scale.
No, it's about 1/8, and it's about... Because it's just...
It can't be 1/8, Dad. It's a fly. 1/8 scale of a fly would be microscopic.
Oh, no.
This is probably 400 scale or something like that. It's big. It's about the size of a grown man's hand
okay.
Right? But thinking about a fly, it'd be bigger.
Okay.
Yes,
no.
I understand what you're saying. I'm just breaking horns.
I mean,
but yes.
But when I built that, what we it's just the piece, it's just the head and the body of the fly.
Yeah.
And what I wound up doing was I got a 2x2 or 2 feet by 2 feet board.
Yeah.
Covered it in black velvet, and then
you bought one of the Halloween store kind of thing.
Yeah, Halloween. Spider's web, and put it on there, and then got a rubber spider that matched pretty much.
Well, but
actually, the key for that was, I mean, it looks great. I've got the words "Help me" on the bottom.
Right, right.
But I put it in your old bedroom.
That's right. It's in my old bedroom.
And it's on the wall. And the thing was, a few years ago, when Luke and
his family,
and his family were up, Jacob was probably either 4 or 5, and he was sleeping in the room, and he came out and he said, "Grandpa, you got to get rid of that monster. It scared the living daylights out of me."
Yeah.
And, you know, I looked at it and I said, you know, he's probably right, because as a little boy, and you see, I mean, it's a really good likeness of the
model. I mean, I built the actual model, fixing all the what he calls in there and stuff.
Yeah.
The model was rough in certain areas,
right,
and not rough in others, but it makes sense because it's not all human, it's not all fly. It should be kind of like that more metamorphosis kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the face likeness is scared. Person is scared. I mean, it's clearly not Al, you know, it's not him 100%. It's just a kind of more, but it's a guy who's screaming,
yeah,
and he, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, you do decent paints on stuff. It looks realistic.
Yeah, well, actually, what Jacob made me do is I actually moved it from the bedroom and put it out on the
on
the wall.
Yeah.
And, but now he's coming again in a couple of months.
He won't be. Haley actually said to me, I go, "Haley, remember it's in Daddy's old room?" She goes, "Next to the guy who looks like Frankenstein?" I go, "Yes, that would be James Arness's The Thing." Haley.
Well, that's so, you know, so we replaced it with the wall hanger of
James Arness's The Thing.
As The Thing. And so,
yeah,
we'll see how that goes over.
Yeah, it's okay. But Haley loves that. Are you kidding me? Anyway, so, but that scene where they're and the problem is it's an animatronic body, and they were moving the spider towards it, and they had to keep reshooting it because every time they looked down, Vincent Price and Marshall, every time they looked, Herbert Marshall looked down, they would just start cracking up. Because it looked bad. Well, the scene, the spider doesn't look great, right? When you kind of see the animatronic spider moving. And it's clearly a guy, and they filmed it real close, and he's like there, you know, doing whatever. And that's not what they're laughing at. It's just when it's easy, you know.
Yeah.
But at this point, though, but you're willing to, again, it's 1958, so you accept that stuff. But the two of them, you know, didn't take it really, you know, they were laughing. But I think I look at it this way. Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, Lee would always say how much he hated, you know, the Dracula scripts, and they were horrible. And he goes, "I don't even have any lines here." And Cushing goes, "Well, that's good for you, because I read it and it's horrible." Like, it wasn't like they were like, "We're making the best movie ever." Like, they were like, "It's a paycheck." And they enjoyed doing stuff, but, it, you know, sometimes you got to laugh at what's there, you know? So.
Yeah. What I wanted to bring out was when Hedison, brings Helene, or Francois brings down,
yeah,
to the lab the first time. What struck me was the how elaborate the lab was.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that 20th Century Fox took a lot of cues from the Universal, like the Frankenstein lab, only modern. There's lights going off. There's no electrodes flying back and forth, but there's all kinds of lights going off and sounds going on.
Well, some of the stuff, that part of the lab set was from Emmerich, the computer from Fox's production on the movie Desk Set from 1950. Yeah, they just reused stuff. They took stuff from other movies. Well, remember, Fox made movies, so they had stuff.
Well, they were one of the biggest companies.
So they probably grabbed a lot of stuff. And I'm not saying they didn't try to make it look, but what is the first thing Francois says? "What a mess! He would never leave it like this." And I'm like, now I know they're brothers, but there's this kind of underlying, you know, like, tone to them.
Well,
because they're French, too.
Yeah, you know? But the set designer
did a great job.
And it looks real.
It looks like a lab, in your basement.
Then when Francois takes the axe and destroys it all.
Andre destroys it with the axe. Francois doesn't destroy it with the axe.
No, Francois. I mean, that's right. Andre.
As the fly, takes the axe to it.
Right.
That's the model we have outside.
Yeah.
Francois, I don't think he does much of anything except this. Maybe he doesn't even really eat his dinner, although he gives Philippe. Oh, that was what I had to bring up. When they're at dinner, he pours the wine in the cup, and then he pours the water in there. And Haley's looking at it. She goes, "What's he drinking?" And I said, and he hands it to Francois. He goes, "Daddy, what did he give him?" I go, "Okay. So he gave him a little bit of wine with a lot of water." She goes, "You're not allowed to do that, Dad. He's a kid." I said, "Well, Haley, if this is a long time ago and, like, this is not real. I guarantee you it's not real wine. It's got to be grape juice. She goes, all right, well, I wouldn't want to drink any wine. My daughter, she is the, you know, the conscious police constantly there.
Hey, when I was a kid,
well, I understand
at Christmas time, when they would bring out the eggnog, my dad would put a little bit of eggnog in a glass, and then fill it with milk, and that was my toast while everybody else was drinking the spiked eggnog.
You're getting, you know, anyway, so we have a couple of emails we want to read, but real quick before I forget, I want to talk about how you can purchase. Now, Dad and I actually both have the exact same set. We have The Fly and The Return of Fly. Put out a long time ago. It's just, they actually put out The Fly and The Return of Fly, and that's part of the double feature collection from Fox. And at the same time, they also put out The Fly and then The Fly 2, the Cronenberg. For a while, that was the only way we get the Cronenberg Fly. Now there's a very nice Blu-ray and a very beautiful Criterion collection, which is amazing. But this is available that way. Now, that's going for about $9.65 on Amazon Prime shipping. Again, if you want to check this out, TwoTrueFreaks.com, hit the Amazon link, order it through there the same way we do all our ordering. Also available, actually, and if you're not interested in The Return of the Fly, and some people may not be interested in the sequel, The Fly 58 and Cronenberg's The Fly together on a double disc DVD. That's from about $19.33 for that. $9.33 for that. The Fly itself on the new disc, they released a new disc of it. That goes for about $7.99 on DVD, $7.35 on Blu-ray, and that was one of the ones they just released when Fox did that mass releasing of stuff a few years ago. But if you're interested in the old Fly and maybe the sequels, the one that you could get is called The Fly Collection. It's The Fly, Return of the Fly, and Curse of the Fly, and that's $18.95. Now, you'd have to want to see Return of the Fly and Curse of the Fly to spend that kind of money, but I don't know how. Curse of the Fly is not readily available otherwise.
Right.
So if you're wanting to get the complete series, that might be a good way to go. I don't think you can go wrong with the one we have, The Fly and Return of the Fly, because they're beautiful prints and everything like that. But again, if you're not interested in the sequel, I would, again, for $7.99 compared to $9, you can get Cronenberg's The Fly if you don't own it, and this, and they're not even, like, they're the same title and they have the same premise, but they are not the same movie.
Yeah, they, you know? The Return of the Fly is not a bad movie. It starts out, Philippe is now a young, he's not that little kid anymore.
No, yeah.
And the thing is that Vincent Price looks exactly the same in Return of the Fly as he did in The Fly.
But he looks the same in all of his movies. So.
Yes, but now it's 20 years later because the...
Right. So
one thing I wanted to do before we get into the emails is, as I'm watching this movie, I mean, I look at the movies in sometimes in a different light. I always look for continuity, and that was pretty good in this movie.
Yeah.
But I had a couple of thoughts that came to mind. The teleportation device that Andre creates was 6 years before Star Trek. Was that how Roddenberry got the idea for the?
I don't know when Roddenberry wrote the.
I know
stuff
that's what I mean. Was it one copying the other or whatever? It's just it.
Was it a leftover piece on a set, like when we talked about Fiend Without a Face? I Married a Monster from Outer Space, when they had the ray gun, and it's the exact ray gun.
Yeah.
Because why? Because it was left over, and they were like, "Hey, we have this ray gun."
Well,
and they used it.
Well, I'm not talking about the actual piece. I'm talking about the concept of teleportation.
Now, you're
400 years now in the future with Star Trek. You know, it's 23
But I'm saying, teleportation, you can probably trace that back to science fiction writing to the
1800s. No, I understand.
You know, just the idea. I mean, well, that was the old magician trick. What was that? The Prestige? Is that the one with the twins?
Yeah.
And he actually makes a teleportation device. He goes and sees Tesla, of all people, and they make a teleportation device. If you haven't seen The Prestige, that's a great movie, too, but it has nothing to do with The Fly.
Well, no, but again, as I said, I'm watching you. Sometimes my mind wanders, and what I thought was, I said, is that how Spock got his ears?
and then the
other thing that you have to suspend your disbelief is, how does the fly, how is he able to type
he's got the one good hand and he's but if the
fly itself can talk, that says to me that the mind, the brain, went with it.
Yes. Well, right. But they were saying is that it was the basics of his vocalization of "Help me, help me." There's no more than just "Help me."
Right.
It's not like "I am Andre," you know, "Francois, save me." Like, you know, it's just help me," the basics. So maybe that's what the idea was, that his mind was still there, but he lost his ability to vocalize it because he didn't have vocal cords anymore. Again, if you're willing to buy everything at this point, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly, that's what I mean.
So, okay. So let's get to a couple emails. The first one, it's from Luke, and it says, "Winter is the season for snow. For snow, Grover. For snow. Crawling Eye and Abominable Snowman." Luke lumped two of them together here. It says, "Jay, good planning having the Crawling Eye and the Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas back to back, as these two late 1950 British black and white rock climbing films starring Forrest Tucker represent a microcosm of Brit sci-fi and demonstrate many trappings of the particular subgenre. Both grew out of early British teledrama style, BBC for the Crawling Eye and ITV for the Abominable Snowman, and thus use more literate dialogue driven style of British TV. This style is best known to American audiences in the form of Doctor Who, which used this low-cost approach for decades until the show went on hiatus in the 80s, the modern version being quite much more active run-from-alien series. We also see this staid, suspenseful approach in the Quatermass stories, which again began on television and they moved to film adaptations of varying quality," which we talked about, Quatermass in the Pit and the Creeping Unknown and stuff like that. "Part of the difference between these low-budget British films and their American cohorts goes back to television as well. While American TV of the era featured more adventurous programming, including many westerns, plus shows like Dragnet, M-Squad, Robin Hood, etc., often driven by advertising, the public nature of British TV meant generally less emphasis on action and more on dialogue, which not only was cheaper. When Aunt B is paying for your show, you tend to go cheaper. And also, it fit better into television's cultural role in the UK at this time, an extension of the radio even more than here in the States." Okay, "Of course, by contractual obligation, I am required to mention that Japanese television sci-fi tended to be much more," you know, it has to get in there, "to be much, much more action-oriented despite their lower budgets, mostly due to a combination of commercial purpose, that is to sell toys, but also different attitudes towards about special effects. In the West, we tend to judge special effects on whether or not they look real, while in the East, there's less important to be to most audiences that whether the image is striking or artistic. Ultraman's pantheon of monsters are classic Daikaiju, despite being non-realistic, as in any sense, while the dinosaur from Last Dinosaur, while striving for realism, are less successful. But I digress. The Crawling Eye has a lot..." The Last Dinosaur. If you want to hear talk about Last Dinosaur, Dr. Bill Robinson and Luke covered that on an episode of Earth Destruction Directive. And then Luke and I covered the Green Slime, which is why we came together to cover Frogs, completing the TBS trilogy. The Crawling Eye has a lot going for it. A great title, a solid story, a lot of suspense, and a memorable monster. I agree that the Trollenberg Terror is a much more fitting title, although you cannot argue with this catchiness of The Crawling Eye, which is what we talked about. Exactly. Yes. The Crawling Eye is a great title to get butts in seats. Trollenberg Terror is more realistic. So, in a lot of ways, it reminds me of them, in that it both seems to sort of malaise along at the beginning, but then they are actually quite suspenseful and really hold your attention. The effects are not as remarkable as those for them, but they remain quite memorable, and the effects folks leave it all up on the screen in the last reel, which is 100% true. You know, the Crawling Eye that they get there. For what it's worth, it's also a great song by the Misfits from their album Famous Monsters. "At these altitudes, it's freezing. Aliens control..." I can't sing it. Luke would sing it for you. "Aliens control human beings. No one has lived to tell who's seen the Crawling Eye." Yes, I do not sing. "The Abominable Snowman really is a lost classic, which is a shame. As mentioned on the show, the black and white helps the film out, as Hammer's typical color palette would not have worked well in his story." Exactly. "The lack of color adds a level of desolation to the already inhospitable environment, making the film appear bleak and cold, a natural fit. Again, the acting is the star here, as the clash between Cushing and Tucker makes for compelling viewing. I usually joke that when a horror or sci-fi director says, 'My film is not about... and then monsters/killer gore effects, etc. It's about people making choices, which is a Lucas said. This is not a movie about Godzilla, but people making choices, which is, you know, some people have said that about the new Shin Godzilla, which Luke has been raving about, which I unfortunately haven't seen yet. That's code for, we totally phoned this in. But in this case, the statement's 100% true. The film really is about men involved and choices they make and how those choices cause repercussions for all around them. It's disappointing that the film is so difficult to find because it's an excellent little piece of intelligent monster horror. Anyway, two good eps about two good movies. Santa Slay was fun, but not really in need of... Not really in need of involved criticism, yes. Looking forward to I Married a Monster from Outer Space, which dropped, of course, in February for Valentine's Day. And another good movie, as I remember it, it's been a few years, with a ridiculous title. Luke, P.S., regarding Untamed Youth, as I have to say, they feed us slop. It's not slop. It's science diet, and it's very expensive, young man. Or if you prefer, don't hit me in the mouth again. You'll break my dental plate, which amazingly is the actual line of dialogue and not a riff. That was some Misty right there. Could we talk about Untamed Youth? They feed us slop. It's not slop. That's science diet. That's Misty. Again, rears his head. But thank you very much, Luke. Yeah, again, a lot of the stuff Luke's mentioning there, we talked about it, you know, in depth on those episodes. If you missed those episodes, go back and check them out. The Crawling Eye, the Crawling Eye was the first episode for December, around the 13th, when we normally drop episodes. And then we dropped the Christmas episode of Santa Slay. And then we followed up with The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas in January to keep the theme going, and which is great. I think one of the things we've been trying to do, and I'm going to touch on it in this next email, we actually laid out a bunch of movies originally, and then we went back and revised what those movies were going to be. Because it was easy to be like, oh, what Harryhausen movie can we cover? And just start covering every single Harryhausen movie, you're going to run out, you know, very quickly. Because he didn't make, you know, 80 movies. He made it, you know, there's all, what, a handful of them, you know, kind of thing. There's not many. So we started looking at other movies, and like, you know, the joke was this was the 1957 podcast, which, you know, came up on the Godzilla, Is It Jaws? Kind of, we were in 57 right. for a while, but it just happened to be the movie we were picking. So we're trying to pick different movies. And to that end, the email here, it's, from Mr. Jack Bone, a very longtime listener of the show and a very supportive listener. It says, a year already? I've been hesitant to write in for fear of letting slip that the best moment so far was when Al Giaconetti, in a casual aside, commonly slammed Cleopatra. Which is still, to my... That's still funny. You're like, ah, Cleopatra. I'm like, compared to being one of the greatest movies of all time. And it's... Well, it's not. But it's, you know, kind of thing. That episode dropped not too long after I'd worked through it on my DVR at an hour a night. And his words captured my feelings exactly. That it was not that good. You know, kind of, like, it was had its good parts, but... You can chop that thing down and make it better, you know, kind of thing. However, as you know, the wide world web is full of fill up with people ripping apart anything and everything, and that shouldn't be encouraged. Still, if you've gone a year without falling into that trap, it's probably safe. The episodes that have been great, one can tell by listening that you enjoyed It Came From Beneath the Sea, but you really, really liked The Beast in 20,000 Fathoms, which is true. I love The Beast in 20,000 Fathoms. One of my favorite movies. I mean, I really like It Came From Beneath the Sea, but that movie, again... It's good, but it's not The Beast enjoying that the fact. I think The Beast also holds a special place, and this is... I was talking about this when I was doing some work for a different network about The Punisher, and I talked about, well, you know, I said, this takes place in New York, and the people I'm talking to, one lives in the West Coast, one lives in the middle of the country. I'm like, well, you guys... You know, I live in New York. I said, I don't live in the city, but I've been to the city, and like, they're talking about Times Square. I'm like, well, I know Times Square, and I know 42nd Street, and I know these things. It's part of what makes it real. The Beast coming into shore in New York City, you're like, okay, I know this, you know, kind of thing. Whereas It Came From the Sea, they're in San Francisco, right, you know, kind of thing. Back to the email. I don't know hard you've strived for balance, but you've been a good mix. B division of major studio, Poverty Row studio, where the alphabet starts with B, direct to video, Roger Corman, Harryhausen, Sam Katzman, and imports. It seems rare that other countries spend as much on their movies as Hollywood, and I've never been to Trollenberg or the Himalayas, but they sound quite modest. Still, the rights to even an expensive film can be picked up by any distributor corporation of America for cheaper than filming. whatever the original language, the transfers to be over here, which is true. You know, a movie may be over there. And again, Trollenberg Terror, they were English. They were easy ports. The Crawling Eye and Trollenberg Terror were easy ports. They're speaking English.
Right.
You know, it's not like Reptilicus where they were speaking Swedish or whatever, and they had to translate. Danish, yeah. Whatever, Danish or whatever. But it's clearly they're not speaking English, and they had to like dub over them. So, looking at this list calls to mind William Castle. Do you know anybody who was there for Percepto or Emergo or any of those other gimmicks that were trademarked? Now, I read that and I said, I actually wrote Jack back about this. And I said, I was not, because I was clearly not born. But you guys might, you and your...
We went to see The Tingler. My brother and I went to see The Tingler, and they talked about, that the seats were going to be wired, but that was only in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And some of the bigger theaters. When we saw it in our local theater, I mean, The Tingler, it's okay. But there was nothing crawling underneath our seat. But the in Manhattan, I'm trying to remember which theater it was. I don't believe it was the Criterion or the Lower East State, but it might have been one of the RKO theaters. They actually had them wired,
right? And with the little buzz thing,
and it became a big deal in the Daily News and the New York Post that patrons get scared at a movie. But that's exactly what he wanted. Yeah. The hype brought people in to see it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what it was. Uncle Danny had mentioned this when we were little. It was a movie where they said, when we sound it, we're going to make it sound, when that happens, if you don't want to see this, then look away.
That was The Tingler.
No. When they cut open the head and they take the brain out or something like that. It was, I don't know. It was some B movie. It probably wasn't very good. I don't remember what it was. But he had mentioned it. He goes, yeah, you ever see this? And we're like, no, because you hadn't seen it yet. And he goes, yeah, when your dad and I went to see it, they said, we're going to make this sound. If you don't want to look, look away. And they took, it was like taking a brain out of something. It was nothing major. I'm thinking, my thinking, of course, is like, maybe the Percepto. Was that with the ghost, the 13 ghosts?
13 ghosts.
Was that what you had to look through the viewer to see him?
Yeah.
And you couldn't see, you kind of could kind of see him a little, but you put him on to really see him. That was kind of the 3D gimmick. But William Castle was ahead of his time in what he was thinking. I mean, talk about making movies for nothing. Like Roger Corman movies look like, blockbusters compared to what William Castle was able to do. But his movies were effective for what they were. I mean, I've seriously not watched House on a Hill again. That movie terrified me as a child because it's going to drip blood on me. Because God forbid the white ceiling. We have white ceilings, kind of thing. At the tender age of 5, that's what happened. It's okay. I watched Ben Casey all night. We're good. And then Lauren Green's New Wilderness. But those little gimmicks and stuff, that was the kind of stuff they put out. In fact, the movie Matinee, the one with John Goodman's in, that plays on a lot of that. And that also plays on communism and the Cuban Missile Crisis and stuff like that as well. But that plays a lot on those ideas. So, and back to the email. And finally, as the token mech head, I'll ask for one of them robots you've been promising in the title. Now, and Jack. So he's Jack is a contributor. Obviously, he's written into Luke's show a lot too. He likes mech stuff and stuff, which is awesome. And that's great. So we were looking at movies coming up, and what happened was, and I actually said this to him, we had planned, originally to do Earth vs. Flying Saucers. And then we said, we probably should move it around. And I think that's when Black Scorpion moved in and other movies. We were going to do Earth vs. Flying Saucers, but we were like, wow, that's going to be like 4 or 5 Harryhausen movies. And we're going to be chewing through his catalog too quickly. So that got moved off. And then Cronus had been talked about. And we had, where can we put Cronus? And we're like, well, let's put this here because we wanted to have, a Christmas movie. That's where Santa Slay came in. And we're like, well, The Crawling Eye really works well with the Abominable Snowman. Let's put those together. It just kind of things, they kind of, just pulling back the curtain, folks. Sometimes you want to know how the sausage is made. You may not want to. Not like this is Hormel or anything. But the next movie coming up, and obviously we're trying to mix things up and we definitely hit on some. We hit on classic, sci-fi movies. The Fly is a classic sci-fi movie that's touched a lot of things. We talk about movies like the Black Scorpion and the Harryhausen movies, but we're gonna get to a little more. Closer to now, and closer to now, 1990. And the movie is Hardware, originally called Mark 13, the Richard Stanley movie that was highly controversial at the time, highly edited, but again, a movie about a killer robot. I mean, that movie's about robots. That's my kind of thing. And a movie that I feel might be one of those lost movies. People kind of talk about it and heard about it and maybe haven't seen it. I know for a long time it was lost. It was the VHS was out there and whatever, but we'll talk about that next time, folks. But yeah, we're going to be talking about Hardware coming up, And as I said to you guys, you know, be on the lookout for, I know we drop one, a new episode every, the 13th every month, because, you know, kind of like keep it going. And then we have our specials, like we had our Halloween special, our Christmas special. But there might be other special things coming, and maybe when you're hearing this, you already heard one of those specials. Maybe we got one and we put it out there. But keep that in mind. And again, feedback is great, and thank you very much to Jack and, of course, to Luke for writing in. It tells us that, obviously, besides people listening, we know people are listening, but, you know, it tells us, you know, what you guys want to hear and, you know, what's good about it and stuff. And I think one of the things Dad and I have tried very hard to do, especially, is that we aren't coming out and just ripping apart movies. It would be really easy to put your foot into Santa's sleigh and tear that one a new one. But I think we've gone out and kind of looked at it technically and, like, well, what works and why did they do this? And, like, even here today, like, talking about, you know, you talk about the way the sets, you know, stay decorated and stuff like that. All those things that come in there, why, you know, why would a star like Michael Rennie not want to play The Fly? And why, you know, and what those things that go into there. We're trying to keep it, you know, obviously looking at movies in a positive way, and, you know, do we enjoy watching these things? And this is the kind of stuff we talk about normally, you know, this and the Yankees, and then kind of thing. And but, you know, but thank you for all the feedback. And again, if you want to contact us, botsbugsbabe@gmail.com, we're gladly, it's in the outro of the show, you can gladly get in touch with us if you have any questions or anything you wanted to, you know, to see, or, you know, movies like, hey, you know, I always loved this movie as a kid, any chance my guys may be doing it? And we'll read that stuff in the show. Anything you want to throw in, Dad, about The Fly?
No, again, it's not a classic, you know, monster movie, but it is well worth watching.
Yeah.
And it's all the recognition and acclaim that it received was well worth it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic piece of sci-fi. It has transcended, you know, generations. The imagery has transcended generations, and the idea, again, you know, is taken. So. So that about wraps it up, folks. Keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag BotsBugsBabesPodcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?